Hello everyone, I'm Jill Trebilcock and welcome to Jill Trebilcock Now with our favourite person and psychiatrist, Professor Stuart Twemlow, who is also a Renshi master of, what is it, Stuart, is it karate?
Yeah, it's a form of karate called Kenpo.
That's right, of Kenpo, a form of karate. So without any further ado, welcome Professor Twemlow.
Thank you.
I believe you have been away and you've been teaching people things.
That's right.
So what have you been teaching them?
Well,
and who have you been teaching?
Okay. I've been teaching a wide range of mental health professionals, ranging from psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, marriage and family counselors, and a number of postdoctoral psychology interns who would be doing the work after they've got their PhD, doing their field work, and social workers. So it's a huge range of people that work in the communities. The thing that this particular set of lectures addresses is all these workers work in the projects. Now, the projects is an American term for slums in your country, probably, ghettos. Places where very poor and disadvantaged and people live. And they work with them psychoanalytically. And so what we were doing was going over how you handle the enormous trauma of very poor people who have little, if any, support economically, little, if any, support in terms of adequate parents, and a government that is increasingly unable to support them, depending on what state they live in. And so it's a big problem. And I would guess within a year or two in the United States, an extra million or two and even more would be added to this list with no extra therapists for them. So America is in a real mess with mental health care services. Anyway, I tried to work with this group to give them ways of most efficiently managing people like that in a caring and humanitarian and altruistic way without becoming panicked and overwhelmed and destroyed themselves. Because when you face what a lot of these people face, you got to remember, you don't get this in Australia, Jill, the sort of horrors of the ghetto with guns. And more than shooting people, guns are used for torturing people and sexually abusing them. And that all goes on with children. And that type of horror is part of what I was lecturing about, trying to help the therapists become more well-adjusted and not distracted by the outrage they have at what happens to these small children.
So, just to stay on this point for a minute, you're saying more well adjusted. In other words, how to cope with the trauma of dealing with trauma, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have your paper in front of me, which always distracts me when I've got something in front of me that you've written. But you say
which paper?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'll have to go to the... It's on altruism. And you say the most destructive effect of the bully-victim-bystander dynamic is a violent mindset where humiliation, creating a sadomasochistic fetishing of the victim with regression.
Yep.
A sadomasochistic fetishing of the victim with regression. What do you mean by with regression? Fetishing with regression.
Well, what I mean by that is that the the person doing the work, and I think in that paper, I can't remember what I put, but one of the examples was a recently returned Desert Storm soldier.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke to a group of middle school children about how his platoon used to amuse themselves since over there in Desert Storm, they had almost nothing to do in terms of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
They used to string up scorpions and shoot them.
Oh, yuck.
And they also used to slaughter camels on camel hunts. And they thought it was sort of cute to kill all of these animals. And they told that to a middle school class, which the teacher thought was very inappropriate, except that these were normal, average Americans. And the thing about regression is regression means returning to a younger age appropriate action. In other words, these soldiers became sadistic children that you might expect from a 12-year-old. That's how they acted, because within all of us is a child, a developmental pattern that we have remembered from childhood. But if we're appropriate and healthy, we just remember it. We don't act it out. We act out what is appropriate for our age. So,
that's,
for example, a 20 to 25-year-old has a whole set of actions that are appropriate for their age that wouldn't be appropriate for a 25 to 30-year-old. So that's what regression is. People under stress, the stress of following trauma of an outrageous degree, become regressed. When they become regressed, they're useless as a therapist.
It's interesting, Stuart. I spoke with a therapist once who specializes in sexual abuse. You might like to comment on this. She actually specializes with sex slaves in Cambodia. And I said to her, a lot of the people I know who've been sexually abused seem to have this terrible temper. And she said, please explain this to me a little bit. And she said, this was her answer. I'm sure I've told this to you, but I've said this before anyway. I don't believe in borderline personality disorder. Is it what she said? Yeah. But I do believe in obsessive compulsive disorder. And she said, so you'll find that these people will actually regress to the age at which the abuse took place and act out in that way. So that's what she was saying.
Yeah. Well, that could be called, you know, a simplified way of looking at aggression. Regression is not as easy as that. I mean, you can understand it that way, but the person who's regressed does not change into a child. They do not become like they were 10 years of age or 12 years of age. They're still adults, and the majority of what they say and do is perfectly appropriate for their age. But part of their behavior is childlike. Borderline people with borderline traits, behavior that's childlike is the need to cling on to a safe object. And the choice of safe object is often a bad choice. They're not safe at all. They're often men who say they're safe because they recognize the need for the woman to feel safe, and they usually abuse it. That's why borderline people end up with abusive, physically abusive boyfriends and sexually abusive boyfriends. That would be a regression in the person with the borderline traits. So it's not, you don't think of the child in complete format. You just think of a pattern of the personality we call transference, which remains there and to which the person regresses rather easily if they have the necessary traits that are borderline.
Right. That makes sense. Well, the article that I'm reading from is called Modifying Violent Communities by Enhancing Altruism, A Vision of Possibilities. And that is actually something that we're going to talk about today. And I sent you an email, and in it I said something. I have to bring it up, but in it I actually I think I almost told you about it.
Hey, Jill.
Yes, Stephen.
Do you want to ask him a question that we discussed a few days ago?
Okay, what's that question, Stephen? I'd love you to ask it for me.
I think we brought up the issue of compassion and altruism. They go hand in hand.
Okay, we'll see. We'll go there. What's the difference between, do you think that altruism is compassion in action?
Yeah, well, that you said that in an email to me, and I would say that's as good a way of distinguishing the two as you can. I mean, altruism is a term established by a philosopher in the 16th century, and there's been enormous amount of writings about it, mostly by philosophers, and almost nothing by clinicians.
Right.
And the main argument is around whether you could be completely altruistic and not in any way narcissistic, or whether there's always some narcissism in altruism.
Well, Ayn Rand said
altruism is described as an action, and compassion is a complicated state of mind. So I think that would be not a bad way of distinguishing the two if you needed to do that. The point about compassion, a lot of people are altruistic in part. For example, I can imagine a mafia boss belonging to the Catholic Church who will donate money to the church and who will be out there cooking hamburgers on a special day for children. And everybody will think he's just like that slob in The Sopranos, serial killer who was a family man, I've forgotten his name. And that person is being altruistic within confines of the religion that demands altruism.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion is a different kettle of fish. I think that's probably not an appropriate way of putting it, but it's a mindset, not a prescribed thing you do. And not only that, the typical mafia boss who's altruistic on Sunday because he's a good Catholic is doing it to try and make sure he goes to heaven, not hell, in spite of his criminal behavior the rest of the week.
Yes,
a compassionate
totally.
Person, as I see it, cannot have that compassion prescribed. In other words, you can't go to a student of yours and say, now, today, you will start practicing compassion. You can't do that. Because unless compassion emerges from the student as a mindset, it is not compassion.
Okay. So
it can't be practiced. It cannot be thought. It has to be enacted in all that you do. So this idea that altruism is an action and compassion is not is really grossly oversimplified. So a compassionate person cannot act non-altruistically. They cannot do it. The best current living example is a Vietnamese Zen master called Thich Nhat Hanh. He's written many books. I would recommend every single one of them. He lived
He's
and
brilliant.
Was brought up in Vietnam during the center of the war. He's a monk who's seen much death and much torture and much horror.
Mm.
And he survived his way through it, and his writings are very good.
Yes, I've read him. Go on, sorry.
His writings are very good, and they're beautiful in the sense that from what he felt in the middle of war and torture was a sad love for the enemy. It's like, how far from God are you that you have not yet seen that to torture children should not happen? And the
yes.
sadness of Thich Nhat Hanh is for the person who is the torturer, not for the tortured. With whom, for whom he has equal, if not greater, compassion. But I would say Thich Nhat Hanh would have equal compassion for the victim and the victimizer as lost souls.
Right.
But his task is to bring them all back to humanity. So you see, it's not simply one is a thought and one is an action.
Actually, I'm just quite looking now for a quote by him because I know he gives beautiful sentences for people to say to people. He says you say something to them, like, and it's. I just realized that now that I understand what you mean by containment, he does suggest that you make very containing sentences.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You say to the perpetrator, "I accept your need to be a monster, and my wish is that you see how that need does not help you or help anybody else. And I will devote myself for the rest of my life to teaching you that." So
yes,
he doesn't give up on the perpetrator, you see. He doesn't put him in a prison, lock him away in maximum security, execute him, for the sort of things we all do.
Yes,
I'm ashamed to be in a state now that slaughtered 39 people last year.
Really?
It was the biggest execution of prisoners in the whole of the United States.
That's disgusting.
Jill?
State of Texas.
Yes, Stephen.
And I'm ashamed of it.
Dr. Twemlow, I know this is totally off the subject, but that actor's, that actor's name was Ted Levine, and the character was Buffalo Bill. in that movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Buffalo Bill, yeah.
All right. Sorry about that, Jill.
That's all right. This is all part of...
Yeah, I remember Buffalo Bill, yeah, for sure. He's a childhood hero of mine.
A hero for Mantras. While we're speaking about it, the four mantras of Thich Nhat Hanh that people could perhaps use. One is, "Darling, I am here for you." Another is, "Darling, I know you are there for me, and I am so happy you are truly there." That sounds like a bit of a wish fulfilling one.
Yeah.
That's an empowering way to speak to somebody, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because people are often there, even but they can't actually articulate it.
Well, you see, the master, I mean, he's a Zen Roshi, the master. Mm. When he articulates it, the compassion has emerged from him. He didn't have to do it. That's just the way he was. And what you get from those sort of mantra, when he says them, is that they are meant 100%.
Yes.
When you get the average person who says that, they're not meant. Sometimes they're not meant at all. They're just manipulations of a person to try and make them feel better. But they may even be positive. They may be just ways of saying something to a person that makes them less upset, even though you don't really mean it. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. I do see what you're getting at. Yes, it's the power of speech.
Thich Nhat Hanh means it.
Exactly. And actually, I know somebody who I would classify as a narcissist. Who actually I handed Thich Nhat Hanh to, and that this particular person, I won't even go into their gender because I don't want to give them away. There's somebody who's fairly close to me. I know they were used in a manipulative sense. The next one is, "Darling, I know you suffer. That is why I am here for you."
Yeah.
And the other one is, "Darling, I suffer. I am trying my best to practice. Please help me."
You see, all those four mantras are part of what is the essence of good psychotherapy practiced by a non-Buddhist.
Yes.
The center of all psychotherapy, whatever the theoretical background, is exactly what Thich Nhat Hanh has just said in his mantra. That's what it's all about.
Mm.
And if the therapist does not feel that, the patient, he or she cannot help them. I'd go that far.
I believe you because so much of our problem is caused by this lack of empathy and compassion.
And sincerity.
Yes.
You know, sincerely meaning it.
Yes.
Not just saying it to make you feel better, you know, meaning it.
Mm. And not spruiking for a get-out-of-jail-free card, but when you say,
no,
"Darling, I..." Yeah. Yeah.
And see, I think that's what makes an enlightened being like Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yes.
He's enlightened because when he says that, there is absolute sincerity and honesty in what he's saying. There is no lying, no manipulation, no, "I'm using this to try and help you because you're miserable and I'd say anything to make you less miserable."
Mm.
Or any of the ways that good people like you and I will sometimes speak just to settle somebody down we don't even know. But when Thich Nhat Hanh sees you as a child of God, it doesn't matter if he knows you, he knows your essence. That's the theory behind all of this.
Yes. So the
God in Zen is not God in the Christian sense. It Zen has its own God, but it's still there. And it's like Mother Teresa. She called all of her poor people the dying destitute. And each one of them was an embodiment of God. She considered it an enormous privilege to be able to wait on and attend to the dying destitute because they were God before her. And when you see a person that way, it immensely empowers them to recover if they can or die in peace. And to me, there's no greater therapy than that. The very best therapists, in my opinion, Jill, are like that. They're like Mother Teresa, they're like Thich Nhat Hanh. They're not, I mean, obviously they're not in the same religious framework or the same degree of being famous. They're just people who really sincerely want to help. And the person who needs help can read it in about 10 seconds flat. And it's hard to say, When I say, when you say, what's a good therapist, I say, I can tell you a good therapist if you show me a session of the very first meeting, and I can hear and see the therapist and patient together. I will tell you if that's a good therapist within 10 seconds. And it's really based on what we've just been discussing.
And
you might say, why did you need to go to medical school or psychology or social work school? I don't know. There are many paths to run, you know. You do whatever you have to do to do what you think you're going to be good at. My path to psychotherapy was surgery. Now, what more do you think ludicrous than that could there be? Cutting people up?
You were pretty
I was good at it, but I realized I wasn't doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to reflect. That's really interesting because, you know, when you look at the way I'm trying to bring this back around to community development and altruism, but at the same time, as there is such a strong, you know, I'm a Tibetan Buddhist, but there is such a strong Christian element in society. And with St. Patrick's Day recently, and, you know, we work out of Ireland a lot, I actually found St. Patrick's prayer, and just one part of it I was very impressed with, and that was St. Patrick wrote a prayer. It was called the Breastplate, St. Patrick's Breastplate. And it's a very popular prayer attributed to one of Ireland's, to St. Patrick. And he wrote it for divine protection. And the part that I like, and I would actually change a bit of it if St. Pat would let me, it's very like the Buddhist Tantras, which is, you know, seeing, and what you're saying, and I'm talking about this as a technique, of seeing the divinity within yourself and seeing the divinity within the other. And so he's written this absolutely beautiful song. Stephen, do you still have the Deer's Cry? We could play it at the end. And he says, Christ within me, it's a way of walking. And in the Tibetans had the same technique. They call it walking like a lion or walking like a tiger. But this one they do with Jesus, and it's called Christ within me.
Is that a YouTube video you sent me or something?
Yeah, I can find it for you again.
Deer's Cry.
The Deer's Cry, yeah. And it's Christ within me, Christ before me. So, in other words, it's saying like, you were saying how hard it, the point I'm trying to make here is we have to generate this compassion. And I think one of the easiest ways to, and I'd like to ask you how to do that. And I'll read you this quick paragraph, and then you can comment on it. Christ within me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ with me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, Christ when I lie down, Christ when I sit, Christ when I arise, Christ in the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks of me, Christ in the eye of everyone that sees me, and Christ in the ear of everyone that hears me. And I would add to that, Christ in the heart of every man I think of, Christ in the mouth of everyone who, in my mouth for everyone I speak to, Christ in my eye for everyone I see, and Christ in my ears for everyone I hear.
Well, you know, Jill, where does an old a religious person like me, where are they in that?
Well, you change the word Christ, the same as I had to change it from, because what I discovered as a Buddhist was it doesn't matter naught what religion you follow. What actually matters is where you put your mind, and you need to put,
absolutely,
yeah, and the way to place your mind in compassion, or to get into deep meditation, to become a deep in what Christians would call divine grace, I suppose, or to become a deep meditator, you have to feel safe. And then when you can let go of all those sort of extra sort of, I don't know what a psychiatrist term for it would be, but all those sort of extra thoughts and things, and just let yourself abide in your own true nature, then you can truly let go. And then we're in that realm of Zen, Stuart.
Yeah,
in the Kensho experience, a Kensho experience. You know, those aha moments where you're no longer thinking and you just let go and you realize that all there is that clear light nature of your mind. And I think you can't do that unless you're very safe.
Well, yeah, because if you're not safe, you won't take a chance.
Yeah, you can't take a chance.
What?
You can't let go. Yeah, it's you're too busy protecting your world.
You protect if you are not safe, you cannot consider any option outside of yourself as safe for you to try. To feel safe, you must be secure. From my perspective, the security comes from the early attachment to the caregiver. Mm. What I'm starting to, and I'm going to translate what you just said somewhat differently. What I'm going to say is that what makes me able to be compassionate or to take a chance is the early attachment I have to a secure parental figure who might be called God or Buddha or just the knowledge of being Buddhist. And I don't have to think of them as some supernatural being, but all of those are features that a child feels about a caregiver.
Yes, that's right.
But if you don't have a decent caregiver, you can't take a chance.
Yeah, but we can't. So what about the people who don't have a decent caregiver? How do they heal that?
Well, it's a very, very good question. I mean, you've raised a $64,000 question. This is what the mental health professionals all over the world today are facing. There's no good answer for that. What has been shown that is positive, I think, and hopeful, is that if a child is put in a family that is healthy, in the sense we've been talking about, if they have had a terrible background, they will grow up with problems, but not insoluble problems. They're problems that a good family can help with and help that child become a productive and happy citizen. That's been shown by direct research, good research. Mm. The issue is not enough of that is available.
Mm.
I must say, without knowing a single foster parent, except the one that I had, there aren't many good foster parents around. They mostly get into the field to get children as slave labor because they want to, you know, deliver newspapers or they have a job which needs a ton of people and they can't afford them. Or they're plain cruel and sadistic. And they can easily become foster parents. And as you probably know, one of the great serial killers of all time was from Kansas City. And he was a major figure in an adoption agency. His primary job was to assess foster parents.
Oh, yes. What was his name? I think we can get an interview.
I don't remember his name, no, but he used to put his victims in barrels and preserve them.
Oh, God. I think I was offered an interview with the one person who actually escaped from him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are you thinking of Jeffrey Dahmer?
Not Dahmer, no. It wasn't Dahmer. The Kansas City guy didn't eat his victim, but he was immensely sadistic, and there are many, many...
Ted Bundy?
Many videos available of him achieving an erection only after he had seriously hurt the woman. I mean, if the woman was positive to him and tried to sexually arouse him, which a number of them did, of course, to try and preserve their own life, it didn't arouse him. The only time it aroused him was when he did something to them that injured them seriously. Then he would get an immediate erection. I've seen it on video.
Would you like to describe, not the erection, but would you like to explain how one's energy can turn like that, that would be sexually arousing?
Well, you know, I mean, I can advance you hypotheses about it, but the fact is, you know, nobody knows for sure. These sort of people, horrifying as they are, you know, Dharma is one good example. There's not enough of them for any scientific study that will conclude why they are like that. Mm. All we can do is describe them. You know, they are people who, generally speaking, are average citizens that don't strike you as monsters if you meet them in the street. They frequently have a job. They frequently have a university degree. They often belong to religious Christian religious movements like Presbyterian. They often volunteer for Boy Scout troop leadership and other good things in the community. They're often liked as sort of not charismatic members of communities, but as quiet people. You know, many of them are deacons in a Presbyterian church or lay preachers sometimes. And they lead an ordinary life that you would not even know all of this awful stuff is going on. The awful stuff comes, the best example of it, if you want to hear the detail, if not, tell me to stop. There's a killer in the United States called the BTK killer, which meant bind, torture, kill. And what he did was every month or two, he would take a special bag of torture devices, and he would pick a family and visit them one evening when nobody was coming around, and he would torture them all to death in the space of about a 24-hour period, slowly. And then he would pack his bags and return home to a job with the city of Wichita, in which he was a prominent civil employee. And he had a wife, and he had two girls who went to college and were excellent students. And the police could never catch him. I don't know how many he killed, but finally he got sick of it, and he sort of gave himself up. I haven't met him yet, but I'm going to go and interview him. He'll interview anybody. He just thinks the police were stupid and finally decided, you know, he needed to not further destroy his wife and children's lives. He needed to be out of their lives and in prison, which is where he is serving a life term. And therein you have a description of a typical serial killer. That's a Ted Bundy, that's Ramirez, that's all of them. They are not monsters with eyes flashing and horns growing out of their heads. Jeffrey Dahmer was actually a very nice person. I saw an interview of Dahmer. I quite liked him. I actually wanted to interview him. The same equivalent of Dahmer in England was exactly the same. Very pleasant man. You go to the pub and invite two or three people back to his place and kill them with drugs quietly, and then over a period of a week he'd eat them and have sex with them and then cut them up and bury them in his garden or try and flush them down the toilet. He finally got caught when one of the hands of one of his victims, he tried to flush down the toilet, got stuck.
Ew.
His toilet wouldn't work, so the plumber discovered the hand. And this man had a father who was a surgeon who used to operate on his son experimentally without anesthesia.
Ow.
So this boy all the time was subjected to incredible torture.
Oh. So do you think...
What can you say?
Yeah, so in a way, it's like a way of trying to understand what's happened to you by acting it out yourself, a complete immersion in the experience. And
That's what that guy did, Richard. I can't remember his last name. But he was essentially the equivalent of Jeffrey Dahmer in England.
Yeah, so
they act out their own childhood experiences. But the problem is, many of them don't have that bad childhoods.
They get blown out.
They certainly don't have the sort of thing that particular childhood, you could excuse the guy almost, because that is horrifying.
Mm.
But many of them had the typical, they had sexual abuse and physical abuse and neglect, but, you know, so did millions of other people who didn't go ahead and kill a whole lot of people. And so, you know, if you bring it round to the matter of compassion and altruism,
yes.
My point about it is people who live in the Stygian pit of hell only live there because they're stuck.
Yes.
Hey, Doug,
a guy like the English fellow with the surgeon father who used to operate on him, there's no way he can get out of any of that. He did everything he could. He was a deacon in the Presbyterian Church. He had a Boy Scout troop. I mean, he had a bachelor's degree and worked for the civil service in England. He did all the things everybody says to do, but he was still scarred with that. And I feel that if compassion and altruism are introduced into the school curriculum from preschool age, that won't happen. But there you have, in a nutshell, my philosophy.
Hey, Doug.
I think that if you treat children as if that is part of what they do, without even thinking, they'll end up not doing it, or the incidence of these sort of horrors will be much less.
Dr. Twemlow?
Yeah.
There's three names that come up when I search for Kansas City serial killers. One is Robert Bedella, Terry Blair, and Lorenzo Gilliard.
The first one, I think, is the one.
Okay.
The key for him was that he worked in an adoption agency, and he put all of his victims in barrels.
So you could use that in your Google search, Stephen. Have victims in barrels added to it.
I think it's the first name you mentioned. It's not, if Carrie is a girl, a woman, it's not Carrie. But those are the two things. And I was involved in his death penalty defense.
Oh, that was interesting. So bringing it back to a community mindset, so we're talking about the difference, like compassion is a very, it is a, what some people could call a spiritual realization, but it is actually realizing, I think, in a lot of ways, our own innate nature. And so in terms of trying to do some community development work with altruism, how do you suggest that people do that? And also tying that in with your idea of teaching children ethics tied with compassion in schools, like Goldie Hawn's doing a fantastic job with that. So what I'm really saying is sort of a summation of where we are so far. So basically what I'm saying is, Stuart, you're saying that we need to teach compassion to children from a very young age. It would be best if the parents teach it and show it and live it and speak to them like Thich Nhat Hanh does.
That we all, every parent should speak to their children as if the children have a duty to the whole community, not just to their own family.
Yes, that's true.
That should start from day one.
You remember I told you I met Marcia Langdon before?
Yeah.
That our children knew each other because we organized an event with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Marcia's daughter and Freeman were chosen. And so the people asked the Dalai Lama, there was a question from the audience, there were 5,000 people there, and they said, how do you rear exceptional children? And of course, Marcia and I were chuffed because the Dalai Lama said, exceptional mothers rear exceptional children.
Yeah.
And or exceptional fathers, you know, exceptional parents rear exceptional children. And I really, really agree with you. It's just incredibly important to rear that child. I imagine Marcia had some sort of, and I'm completely making this up, realization as a professor herself, you know, that she's the importance that her daughter as an Aboriginal, or there's a better word for it, they like to be called original caretakers, is I've heard, as an original caretaker of Australia. She would be rearing her daughter Ruby with this in mind, you know, with as you're saying, just taking that incredible care with your child, knowing that they're going to benefit people, or rearing them, you know, to teaching them empathy and compassion and teaching them. Yeah. And so now you want to do this to we all do, and you have some ideas on how to do this with the community. Yeah. And so
I do.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of the things I did in the last week or two was meet with my colleague, Frank Sacco, in Boston, and a computer expert. And we have two websites, and one of them we renamed buildingpeacefulcommunities.net. And that will be the intellectual bridge of our work. It will contain the projects, all the papers we've written, we have time to put up that people can download free. It will connect to the journal that we have. It will publish papers written by people doing this sort of work. And it has a project gallery of all of the countries that have put into action these ideas. And then we have another website called backoffbully.com that is going to be designed to sell for a very cheap price some of these things, because, you know, we need money. And what's happened to me, as I've told you, is I had a lot of money as a professor. I now am retired, and I have no money, and I can't do anything. So we're going to try and see if we can make some money. Of course, Frank and I give it to people who want it if they have no money, but there are some people who will pay $4.99, you know, for a videotape or something. But
well, the thing is, I'll just jump in here.
What the second website will do. Yeah.
That's a good idea. Everybody who's listening, even if you can't afford to buy the book for yourself, if you go to your local library and ask them to get it in, at least, you know, you can get a purchase in. I mean, you know, it'd be best if you have your own model at home, but the libraries will buy them in, and it would be fantastic for people to wander down to the library and find Back Off Bully by Professor Twemlow and Frank Sacco in there. So go and ask your libraries. And then otherwise, what was the name of that website, Stuart, to get in Back Off Bully?
Well, the initial website will be buildingpeacefulcommunities.net. And the other one is backoffbully.com. Now, let me tell you the titles of the books. One book is called Why School Anti-Bullying Programs Don't Work.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And that was published in 2008, and it's available from Amazon.com or from Roman and Littlefield. And the other one was called Preventing Bullying and School Violence. That was published in 2012, and it's available from the American Psychiatric Press Incorporated. And both have it in print, and the initial one, I think, costs $30, and the other one may cost $50. But Amazon.com has the first book, but the second book is held by American Psychiatric Press, Inc. So you can get it by APPI, or just Google American Psychiatric Press, Inc., and you'll find it available. And, you know, we're not talking about hundreds of dollars here. These are cheap books, and they're printed to be useful to people. And if you want to learn about the stuff that I'm talking about, that's what you do. Buy the books, read them. We haven't written a purely theoretical book, and I am going to write that, but not at the moment. We're still trying to get the project itself up and running, and frankly, to get enough support financially to be able to make it happen. Because at the moment, unless I can raise the sort of money that Marcia raises, or I don't know how much she raises, but some of your people raise, I'm dead in the woods. I don't have a bean to put into this. Unless I can get a Bill Gates or somebody like that to fund me, we'll just be constantly trying.
Right. We've got to plug that. And I did say that I might have a word with Chris Hooper. We haven't spoken. You and I never speak offline. We only ever speak at the time of the show. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking, does Stuart keep this distance from me the way he would from a client? Because sometimes I thought, look, I really need to Skype Stuart and ask him something. But anyway, this is something we can discuss off air. But the point that I'm want to make is Stephen's put in that we've got 10 minutes left, and I'd like to talk about we just need to bring to consciousness the importance of altruism in our community and compassion in our community, and just get it part of the conversation, because we do need to teach altruism in schools. And at the moment now, you know, they're removing a lot of religions from schools, and I don't know why they're not replacing them with ethics and virtue ethics, because what I found for me anyway, even though I did have an innately compassionate heart, I used to cry for animals and things when I was young. Which I suppose we all did, and I have to thank my parents for, you know, having some sensitivity to the creatures around us. I'm getting lost here. It's the importance of teaching children altruism and compassion and ethics in school. We could be putting that in. So many people say, oh, you know, we can't get rid of religions because that's where our moral values come from, but that's just absolute nonsense. Our moral values come from seeing the other person as a feeling being, and saying, just as I am a human, I am a feeling being, and I wish to have happiness and avoid suffering. So do you, Stuart, a feeling being, and you wish to avoid suffering and to have happiness too. And if we can even just teach that to children, that sort of empathy, from there can arise compassion. But we don't even have it commonly known in our society how to actually get the person to internalize that experience, to grow that compassion. We have a patriarchal approach to compassion where it's top down and we go, oh no, don't hurt them, and you know, yeah, let's talk about that just for the last few minutes. How do you propose to teach communities to show more empathy and really emote or more than that, sort of?
Very simple.
Good.
Very simple. I start with preschool children.
Mm-hmm.
I focus all my attention on elementary school and preschool,
mm-hmm.
and almost nothing elsewhere. See, we have to get to children when they're most open to new ideas. At that period of time is preschool through fifth grade. That's when children will take in anything and evaluate it. A good illustration of it is my kids. That's how they've been taught from birth, and that's how they are. All my kids are different, and all of them have the usual sort of issues that every kid has, but the one thing they all do, literally, is help constantly whenever they can. None of them bully anybody. All of them protect, at school, protected the bully. One of my kids was a black belt, and he was known for protecting bullies at his school. And on the way home one day, a bunch of sixth graders, when he was in the third grade, accosted him on the way home and were going to beat him up. And he stood back and he said, okay. He said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to step in and punch you. Please feel free to protect yourself against the punch. But after I punched you, I want you to think twice about attacking me again. And he did. He stepped in, punched him, punched the sixth grader. The sixth grader collapsed. He was still conscious, but he was unable to stand on his feet. The rest of them ran away. My son went back to the kid who was on the ground and stayed there until he was conscious and able to sit up. And he apologized to my son. And that was the last trouble my boy had.
So then,
he's an altruistic, compassionate person.
Mm.
He just simply was powerful enough to make sure his altruism worked. He didn't do it out of wanting to be sadistic. He just showed the other side that he was not stupid. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
he's a gentle warrior. Yeah. You don't. I'm not saying you should lie down and let everybody slaughter you.
Absolutely.
In the sense of Mahatma Gandhi. I'm saying you should learn to protect yourself. Learn martial arts. Learn combat. Learn how the other side lives. Learn the skills, but only use them for the good of others, protection of others.
That's right. And to teach your children that, and even just to give them the language.
Teach your children that. Exactly.
Yeah. Dr. Twemlow, Jill?
Yeah.
There was another name that came up with the with the search. It was John Edward Robinson.
I think that may have been him.
Two of his bodies were found in chemical barrels, 85-gallon chemical barrels.
That's him.
Yeah.
He was probably belonged to an adoption agency.
Right. Yeah. So, Stephen, how do you rear somebody that wants to put people in barrels?
Well,
how do you not rear somebody?
I don't know, Jill.
Come on, we're just having this conversation.
I know. We should go ahead and wrap this up here, though.
We don't know. My God, Jill, if we knew, we would do something. I just spent 10 days in the home of a friend of mine where there were lots of young children, young teenage girls around 17, 18. Ready to go around the world. You know, the people that go around the world are always from affluent families. They're never from ghetto families. And they go out with this idea that mother is still there protecting them wherever they happen to be. And I was utterly horrified to hear what they planned to do on almost no money by relying on the goodness of people that I knew did not exist.
Yes.
What can I say? Yes, you're young. Yes, you carry your mother with you. Yes, you think that she will protect you even if you're in the middle of Russia. But let me tell you, when push comes to shove, mother is not there.
No, mother is not there. And mother is a universal mantra too. You were saying, Stephen's saying we should wrap up, and I'm just saying to Stephen, do you know, Stuart, when we actually wind up your shows and we do a thing called truncate, we normally take about 10 to 12 minutes of pauses out of an hour's show with you.
Yeah, all right.
So not in the videos, Jill.
Pardon? No, we what? Can't not truncate the video. Are we in a video now, Stephen?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, sorry about that. So I'm trying to tell the producer what to do. How unusual of me.
Been a pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to both of you, as usual, as always.
Yeah, we enjoy talking with you. So in terms of wrapping up, basically, yes, we always love speaking with you, and we're trying to work out the best thing people really can do is buy the books. Would you say the names of the books again, please, Stuart?
The books I wrote are only focused on school bullying.
Yeah.
And one is called Why School Anti-Bullying Programs Don't Work.
Yep.
And it was co-authored between myself and Frank Sacco.
Yep.
And the other one is called Preventing School Bullying and Violence, and that was written by me and him. And the one publisher was Roman Littlefield, and the other was American Psychiatric Press. But, you know, the stuff we're talking about in a more general, broad, worldwide sense is not in those books. I mean, I may write those books, but, you know, I mean, I got my friend gave me a book called Beyond Violence or something like that. It had Pope John's Pax, his encyclical. It was called Pax Terram, Save the World. Right at the time of the invention of the atomic bomb. And it had quotes from all of these people, famous people, that all say the same thing. Here's what we should be doing. The issue, frankly, is nobody is doing it. Yes, you can create a massive 501c3 and become world famous because you've spread your ideas about care of children. I hear about them every single day.
Mm.
None of them make one bit of difference to the world.
Mm.
That's the question I'd love you to ask your listenership, your listeners. Why is it that all of these great ideas that every famous person has talked about, from Martin Luther King to Bertrand Russell, from Pope John to Aristotle, why aren't we doing it? That, to me, is the fundamental question. Carl Menninger thought that what we were doing was destroying ourselves systematically. Not a very nice thought, right?
Right. Well, you know, and the thing is, I mean, I have strong opinions on that, and that is that we are too materially focused and not enough spiritually focused, and we've been putting too much praise on people for creating things that we can actually see, and not enough praise on people that are creating things that we can actually feel. Even though, mind you, they've made, you know, we've got people who we admire, like Martin Luther King and the Dalai Lama and Gandhi and these people, and we do need to teach our children more about these people as role models. And
not just people, what their values were.
Exactly.
Why they had those values. Did they just make them up for fun, to make them famous? Hell no. They realized at the end of their lives, mostly when they were old, that if you don't live the way they said, you're going to destroy yourself. None of those people saw that when they were 20. None of them. Why is it all us old people that see the way things should be? See, why can't young people see this? Maybe we should talk about that next Thursday. Why can't young people realize what they have to do? Here's a topic for next Thursday.
All right. So with that,
absolutely,
Professor Twemlow and Stephen Roberts and People's Internet Radio and Cancel the Cabal and April Rain's We Roar Radio, thank you so much for having us. And Professor Twemlow, thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure.